Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. This week we'll be talking to the author of No Matter, Theories and Practices of the Ephemeral in Architecture, Dr. Anastasia Karadinou from the School of Architecture, University of Portsmouth, UK.
Okay, great. So we're doing something unusual for New Books in Critical Theory this week. We're in a cafe in Islington in London. Usually when I do these things, I don't get to meet the person I'm speaking to. It's usually, you know, kind of, if they're American or Australian, it's usually over the internet. So it's a pleasure to kind of sit down and have a cup of tea with one of the authors. So would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great pleasure meeting you and taking part in this fantastic blog you're working on. I'm an architect and a senior lecturer at the University of Portsmouth. My name is Anastasia Karadinou. Over the last few years, I've worked as a practicing architect, researcher, and also I've been teaching architecture in Portsmouth, at the University of Portsmouth, for the last 3 years, more or less. Before that, I was in Edinburgh, where I was teaching and doing research. So I've lived in the UK for a number of years, in Greece before that. And the work that is presented in the book was partly done, major part of it was done in Edinburgh between 2005 and 2010, roughly. And more recently, I published it as a book.
Is this the first book you've written, or have you other academic papers?
It's the first book in the form of a kind of monograph or something. Before that, I was the main editor of another book and of a journal issue.
Because architecture is structured slightly differently from other areas, sort of arts, humanities and critical theory research in the UK, whereby there's a lot of crossover with practice.
Yes.
So architects tend to, you know, they have their own practices and they might come in one day a week.
Exactly, yes.
So were you working sort of in the field before you became an academic?
Or? Yes, I was working as an architect, and while I was doing research, I was still working as a freelance architect, undertaking projects in practice.
And are you still doing that now? Have you still got
Yes.
And how does that work in terms of combining?
Well,
a very kind of rich, dense, very theoretical informed text with the demands of a client, or, you know, someone who wants something, you know, built or something like that. How does that work, those two worlds?
Well, one could say that these two worlds are quite different, but at the same time one could say that they're not that different, and to be honest, I couldn't imagine myself doing just one or just the other. In my mind, one informs the other, and all the collaborations I've got in academia inform my work in practice, and all the collaborations I've got in practice inform my work in academia. But I can understand that this is not really kind of straightforward.
Yes, I understand completely. And I think this two worlds is shown quite clearly in the book as well. So I'll turn to the book now, which is called No Matter, Theories and Practices of the Ephemeral in Architecture. And I think I said earlier, it's a fascinatingly kind of rich, in-depth, detailed text, because it covers both, I suppose, people's individual experiences of the built environment, but also it has very specific points to make about architecture theory as well. And one of the ways you do that is through setting up an argument that architecture theory depends on particular divisions and particular ideas.
Absolutely right. The main idea of the book has to do with this kind of paradox, exactly what you present, that as several theorists have argued, architecture is on one hand something that is experienced, something that that sometimes remains in the background. People experience it by habit, by being in it, by encountering spaces, by living through spaces. And on the other hand, one could say that architecture is perceived as a world of ideas and concepts, or in other words, as an interesting form, or as an image, or as a building or a construct that one perceives by focusing his or her attention to it. Walter Benjamin describes it quite clearly when he, when he talks about the buildings being perceived, being experienced in a twofold way by touch and by vision. So, on one hand, one can experience buildings by paying attention to them, and on the other hand, he is experiencing them more without focusing on them, by living in them. Bernard Sumi talks about a similar thing when he's using the metaphor of eroticism. And he says that buildings buildings are on one hand perceived as a concept, and on the other hand they are lived in. So that as a paradox, because what he says is that one cannot simultaneously position himself away from the construct and contemplate upon it, and at the same time being almost unintentionally immersed in it. So there's a paradox. We cannot be in these two conditions, immersed in these two entirely different conditions simultaneously.
So is this where the idea of the ephemeral comes in and is useful then, or is the ephemeral something completely different?
The ephemeral in this book as a notion is analysed and is described and discussed in a number of different ways. With the notion of ephemeral, or rather, I present it the other way around.
Okay.
The notions that I was initially looking at are notions such as the intangible in architecture, the atmospheric, the ambience, the elusive. So these aspects of space that we cannot quite represent or grasp, those that remain in the background.
And are they the things that make sense of something being lived in rather than something being looked at, something being experienced visually?
Yes, maybe.
That sounded like a qualified yes.
Yes, that's right. What exactly do you mean by that?
When you're drawing those distinctions from Walter Benjamin and Sumi as well, it struck me that there was a distinction between, I suppose, almost how the architect and how discourses of architecture see buildings and discuss them in visual terms, almost as a sort of aesthetic object, whereby we understand buildings, we can think, oh, that's hideous, or, you know, oh, that looks lovely, or that lends it with the background, these kinds of things. And then opposed to that is the lived reality or experience of being in a place, you know, some buildings being spooky because they're very old, or buildings, you know, feeling clean because they're brand new, or, you know, these kinds of, yeah, as you say, atmospheric ideas. And the two different poles that, you know, as you say, you can't exist in both.
The way you describe it is really, really interesting, because one can respond to that yes, the way we experience space in our everyday lives is the latter, through immediate experience. However, one could also argue that it's not that, it's something that does both at the same time. And that's where
real time. So I slightly kind of stopped you in your tracks when you were explaining the ephemeral in the book. And you said, you use it in a lot of different ways. So could you say how these different ways are used and how it fits?
The notion of the ephemeral was actually a result of some bits of the research.
Okay.
So my initial purpose was to examine these intangible qualities. And in the process of examining them, different types of experiments and processes were followed. As is presented in the first and second chapters of the book mainly, I argue that I don't... study, it's rather that the theory is informing a core process is raising some questions.
It sort of makes sense when you unpack it like that, because the book is both full of questions, but also, I think, because of its theoretical basis, tries not to start off with a linear, straightforward narrative of here is a problem, here is how I will solve it, which, you know, is quite common to arrange in humanities and science thinking, but also I think it's quite common in architectural terms as well, you know, kind of the design, engineering aspect. And how that set of questions plays out, I think there's a range of things I'd like to talk to you about. First one is that kind of theoretical basis, the theoretical starting point. So you mentioned Walter Benjamin, another important theorist or set of ideas is that kind of Deleuzean idea about the kind of the rhizome, you know, unfolding rather than having kind of linear straight lines. I just wonder if you could comment on the way theory informs the subsequent chapters and the work. Or maybe not.
Yeah, well, definitely. There are different ways into certain questions.
Yeah.
As you said, one could design as an experiment, let's say, almost a scientific experiment, and conduct them and come up with some results. Another way is to let the questions lead to specific praxis, specific actions. We could also call them experiments, but which are designed in a fairly open way. So we didn't start with a very... In this book, I don't start with a very specific hypothesis of what the output, the outcome, the results should be or would be. I engage in a number of processes and let the process reveal aspects of space, of the questions. For example, when I was conducting the sound recording experiment, it was a very... project in the sense that I was prepared to have negative outcomes, like in science, with an experiment, and then there is no valuable outcome, which still would be an interesting thing to observe. In that case, maybe I wouldn't include it in the book, but it would still be an interesting thing to do. So, for example, in that section of the book, my question was, as architects, we generally focus on the visual, and that's great, that's fine, that's very valuable and useful. So my question is, if for a while we focus on the sonic, would that tell us something about the space, the city, the way we experience our environment, or not. So, in order to address this set of questions, I thought, okay, the only way is to go and do something with sound in cities, such as record specific places, specific routes, and then conduct a number of experiments in relation to that. One of the experiments, for example, was to invite a number of volunteers and ask them to listen to these recordings and transcribe what they thought they heard. And a number of fairly interesting outcomes appeared. Then, at a later stage, I tried to transcribe the sound recordings into visual diagrams, visual graphs, and see if that would reveal something about the place that other media and other processes wouldn't reveal. And again, there are some things revealed, although I have to say other stages of the experiment were much more successful, like the stages where the sound was displayed together with the maps. That gave a better understanding of the places.
This you're talking about the chapter beyond the visual versus the non-visual side of your senses. You've introduced that division in architecture. You kind of, I think you draw from Jack Derrida on this, the privilege of the visual in architecture, and you kind of relegating the non-visual. And those sonic experiments were designed to sort of disrupt that division. It was very interesting that it played out across, you know, kind of gallery installations, across interactions with individuals, with mapping projects as well. And for a critical theory book, it was fascinating that it was so empirical. Yeah, it wasn't just a kind of broader reflection on architecture theory, but actually it was a set of practices.
As you said, it started from the way the book is organized is around three main chapters. Each one of these three chapters is discussing one specific dichotomy, one specific binary position. I'm referring to Derrida's model of binary position, where he says that usually in such dichotomies, one notion is privileged over the other. So we have the primary and the secondary notions. For example, form, matter. Both are fundamental in architecture, traditionally. But throughout architecture history, form is associated with the conceptual, the idea, the visual, and matter is associated with the experiential, the senses, the everyday, the ephemeral, and so on. So what Derrida says is that in order to open up a dichotomy, or actually what sometimes happens is that the secondary notion is elevated into primary notion. And when this is done, usually a third notion is introduced, which opens up this dichotomy. For example, I'm referring to chapter 3, which is actually the second one.
Substantive, yeah. And this is before, beyond the formal versus the material, the idea of performance.
And in that case, the ephemeral, which is used like as the title of the book, is here discussed in the form of the notion of performative. So the notion of the performative in this section is introduced to open up the dichotomy between the form and the matter. To describe some parts of the discussion of this chapter in simple words, one could think of some specific buildings. Let's say the Blair project of the Lerns Cathedral, a fantastic project built several years ago.
And where is this? If you could say a bit more detail about that.
Okay, it's I'm referring to this specific example because this building was actually made of evaporated water. It looked like a cloud.
Yeah.
Above a lake. So actually form and matter. Well, what was form, what was matter? It was evaporated water. It was in a constant state of change. Other examples could be Toyohito's wind tower, where
specific sensors and microphones were capturing the speed of the wind and the sound of the city, and the tower was lit in different ways based on what was happening in the broader area.
And which city is this? Because, I mean, people won't have read the book and seen the diagrams. So
yes.
Whereabouts is that?
Tower of Wind, I think it is in Tokyo. So this example again is showing that in some cases foreign matter could really be distinguished.
And you have the same sort of experimental method here. So the book, I mean, this is difficult to illustrate on a podcast, but the book is full of really interesting photographs and pictorial representations of things like mapping projects, change the way kind of demolitions change landscapes, or building sites change landscapes as well, and you know, there's kind of mapping projects that go along with this too. So I wonder if you could say again on the kind of the distinction between formal and material and the idea of the formative. How do the experiments get to grips with the idea of the formative? How do they engage with the idea of the formative. If that's slightly the wrong question, maybe you could just say a bit about what the experiments were. So what was the performance of mapping?
The question is absolutely right. The notion of the performative was addressed through a number of experiments again, through a number of mappings, where what was mapped was not only what was static in the city, like buildings, roads, bridges, and so on, or even just some specific formal functions. What we had attempted to map with my colleagues at the time was to map the very specific experiences we had within the city. So our attempt was to re-perform through a mapping process our journey there. So it was not a map of
a place or a territory.
It was not a map of not even of events. It was a re-performance, a reenactment of the journey there. So the map-making process itself was the map. It was not the final object what mattered, but it was the understanding that the process, this process of map-making revealed.
And the sort of the process takes place across a whole kind of eclectic range of cities across the world. It's very interesting, kind of, you know, you talked about being in Edinburgh and, you know, sort of being based in Edinburgh when you were doing the work. But, you know, it's a global work, you know, because the examples are from all different parts of the world and quite eclectic. And I think this eclecticism is a route into the other kind of major topic that you get towards, which is this question of digital and social media. And this is the kind of fourth and final substantive chapter, the, you know, beyond the physical versus the digital, the hybrid. And I still have a couple of questions about that, but I wonder if you could just talk us through what's going on in that division between physical and digital and the idea of the hybrid.
In this chapter, I also present some discussions around one of the main questions set in the book, which also presented in the back cover, which was one of my initial questions when I started this piece of research. So my question was, in contemporary world, where there are so many different digital media involved in our everyday lives, like mobile phones, GPS systems, smartphones, wireless networks that we connect to in different parts of the city, a range range of different gadgets, media, technologies, and so on. So my question was, how does the emergence of all these media influence our way of thinking about space? What are the implications of those media in our everyday experience of space, the way in which we map and interpret spaces, the way in which we design spaces as architects? So that was a very broad question. And again, the answer could have been, well, it doesn't really matter. So by conducting a number of experiments throughout this research time, which are presented in this chapter, but not only, some are in previous chapters, was that digital media mainly influences as a tool to think with about space. And because through these media, time, temporality can be mapped more accurately, then the notion of the ephemeral in time is introduced in the design process in a more substantial way. For example, again, a very, very simple example could be that a few years ago, we couldn't very easily make animations of spaces. Exactly. We couldn't visualize how it would feel like walking in a space. This is a very, very simple example. Other examples are have to do with previous experiments that I referred to. For example, in the past, it would be really difficult to map accurately the sound of spaces. For these experiments, binaural microphones were used, so a very accurate recording of the sound, of the surround sound, was mapped. So this would have been more difficult with the technologies of the past. Mm.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Making websites...
Having to do that with, you know, yes, analog or onto tape. But,
exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. Having the possibility with our very kind of...
And also the use of the sites as well. So, you know, the photographs in China, you know, that would have been sort of much more difficult if you happened to take lots and lots of equipment with you out to the sites.
Yes. And at the stage of analysing the findings and experimenting with the way of working with them, having the possibility to make websites so easily and create an entirely different type of narrative than the one you make when you make a video or a book or a text. So represent, for example, in the section of the sound mappings of Edinburgh, a number of websites were produced where you could click in parts of the city and you could listen to the sounds and then try to reflect on how that relates to a specific location and so on. So this wouldn't have been possible, wouldn't be so easy, or it wouldn't be a tool to think with for us 20 years ago.
And it's interesting that, you know, it's the sort of the relationship with, you know, the kind of, this is fancy work in Edinburgh in the same chapter, which is the kind of visual, non-visual chapter. You know, you've got that kind of relationship with Venice, the Greek Pavilion, which in turn, you know, is a kind of site.
Interactive intervention, yes.
But it's a site in Venice that is about Athens and is, you know, attempting to kind of sonically represent Athens in another city in the context of an international art fair. So as you identify all of these, both, I suppose, the research methods, but also many of the research objects are made possible, plausible, practical by digital media, which is very interesting because I think this is something that perhaps in the design of built environment urban space, you know, we have these questions about maybe environmental standards or, you know, what will it look like, but there isn't a question of, you know, how are the everyday practices that we're experiencing as transformations around things like being set in East, you know, East London Cafe recording this with you, how is that impacting our architecture?
That's a very interesting observation. It really links to everyday life and experience of things. That's exactly what you said. Like, a few years ago, maybe we wouldn't sit in a cafe to have this discussion. It wouldn't have been so easy. We wouldn't have these gadgets so readily available to us. So in that section of the book, as you said, one of the observations is that digital media function as tools to think with about space and also about space through time. So the notion of time is introduced in this way. And another way to look at it, as you said, like in the past, it's not only that these media were not so available so easily, it's also that traditionally there was this perception that the digital is something kind of opposite to the tactile, the senses. That's another traditional dichotomy that I am questioning or examining. You know, on one hand, we have the tactile experience of things, very immediate experience of things, of the physical world. And on the other hand, we have the world of the digital media, the virtual. So, if we think of texts of Johann Palasma, he reflects upon the thinking hand. And my understanding of his text is that what he says, and I kind of agree to that, one cannot replace this immediate relation to the hand as a medium of expression. Okay. Now, one could argue, though, that specific new media could, instead of limiting this tactile experience,
the immediate relationship,
exactly, they could even enhance it in specific cases. For example, you're probably familiar with the 3D pens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to two different types. There is one where you hold the pen and you draw in three dimensions, and this is represented in a virtual world in the computer. But there's also the new kind of 3D pen, which is still in an experimental stage, where with some sort of material, synthetic material, you draw as if you make a model.
3D
drawing.
Quite crazy, actually.
So this very immediate tactile sense of the hand can be now used in three dimensions. And in the future, it may be the technology will.
And again, it's interesting that kind of transformation in architectural terms of the phases of drawing a model, and so on and so forth. They get broken down, and those, again, that kind of Davidian opposition just starts to disappear and you can understand. It's really interesting. One of the points that I was interested in right across the book before I sort of about the way you conclude or actually don't conclude the book is the problem of sort of representing this stuff in the text. And it's something that obviously Derrida is your sort of starting point, and people like Benjamin as well, and architectural theorists like Shimmy, and people like this who are the theoretical end of architecture. There is an interesting question about these things as very heavily concerned with representation, and you're talking about digital, sonic, and performance in the three main chapters of the book, and yet it's a book. We both have copies in front of us. It's a material object. It's got that kind of weight that a hardback book does. So I wonder, how did you sort of get to grips with, I guess, collating all of this learning, all of this kind of information, and getting it into a book, in a form that has a beginning, has an end, has pages and pictures and letters and words and stuff like that?
That's a very interesting question. One could say that the question that I set is an almost impossible question, in the sense that I'm trying to explore what resists analytical representation. So one could say that actually the processes that I followed in order to explore that cannot be mapped themselves either. However, one could argue that by presenting the
processes, the events, the experiments. Yeah. One is, in some sense, becoming exposed to those and experiences space in a different way.
It's the sort of, I guess, in the revelation, in the presentation, you can't sort of unlearn what you've read, you can't forget the knowledge that you've got from reading a book. So you have that sense of, I know what these experiments have been, I have some understanding of the experiments, and so my relationship with space is changed almost because of that.
Katie Lloyd-Thomas presents in one of her books that, you know, this book or any building, she's using the example of the book, which I find quite successful, is not just its content. Well, it is its content, the narrative, the stories that it tells, but actually, as an object, it's got some materiality. So the other day, my students had asked her to give a lecture and present the book to them. So it just started by, well, you want me to talk about this book? This book weighs like 200 grams, is made of paper, parts of it possibly recycled, but it says here like ethically resourced or something. It has been printed a few miles south from London. A number of people worked from it, from different countries, from different places. Katie Lloyd-Thomas is using the example of both the book and the building. So it's, what matters is not only what it represents, what story it tells, but also what it does. She was also referring to buildings. A building is not only a finished object, it's also a number of processes it activates in order to be built. It's the number of workers who work there, technicians, contractors, builders, architects, engineers. They come from different places. The materials the building is made of come from different parts of the world. All these stories and all these events are part of the building, or in other words, are what the building has done. Now, this maybe is not answering the question in a straightforward way, but what I want to say is that through this book, I present a number of processes that I followed with several colleagues I worked with throughout those years. And I map those processes. So the narrative is not a linear narrative on purpose. It's a narrative that is disrupted by things that happen, experiments that happen, outputs that are unanticipated. So it, in some sense, it is a designed process. It is designed, though, in a fairly open way, so as to allow for unanticipated things to be encountered and revealed.
I see. And this is quite clearly shown in the conclusion, which is not a conclusion. So the book is quite explicit about not having a concluding chapter that says, and here's what you've just read, I hope it makes sense. It says, there are lots more questions now, and we need to think about them instead of reviewing and kind of concluding. So I guess this takes me to this question of sort of, where are you going to go next with both what's in the book and potential new projects? And are, I suppose, is your future work going to be still in this line of sort of disruption, urban experiments, and raising kind of questions for architecture theory?
Well, before I move into that, I would like to ask if somebody reads the book and has any objections, comments, I'm more than happy if they contact me to let me know what they think and any mistakes I've made, any things they entirely disagree with. I would be absolutely perfectly happy with that. I would be really enthusiastic, actually. Now, concerning what I'm doing now, to be honest, it is not a linear continuation of this. This book had come out of some quite genuine questions I had about architecture. Like, as architects, well, what do we do in this world? You know, what do we design? Actually, there's so many things that are beyond our control. Jeremy Till describes this whole thing so accurately and in such a great way in his book, Architecture Depends. So, my question was, can we examine in any way, or can we experience, or how could we encounter the ephemeral, atmospheric, intangible aspects of space? And as we discussed a while ago, the second question was, how do new media influence the way in which we approach and design space? So, and then I argue that these two are linked and one informs the other. So when this book, when I started writing this book, working on this research, a number of books were published really at the same time, within 10 years, on different aspects of the ephemeral, intangible, immaterial in architecture. And I found that quite interesting. So there is an obvious link between that, the inquiry about the ephemeral, the intangible, and the emergence of a new media. So, now, working on a, one could say, entirely different project. You can tell me if there's anything to do with my previous research. I collaborate with a neurophysiologist from Queen Alexandra Hospital, Dr. Christopher Moore, and a number of colleagues from health sciences and psychology in the University of Portsmouth. And we are starting conducting some experiments with brainwave mapping. We are using this new portable EEG device. EEG is the
brain scan.
Yeah. You know what that is?
So
that couldn't be portable up until recently, or it was really difficult to carry with you the whole equipment. In the last few years, some new devices have been commercially available, and one can actually map brain activity and be walking around the city. So the first team, to the best of my knowledge, that started working on that was Richard Coyne, Professor Richard Coyne from Edinburgh, who was also my PhD supervisor at the time. So together with his colleagues, they had started working on that. And their research and papers were really, really inspiring. So with my colleagues, were working in the same broader area, and we're trying to compare the brain responses in real environments, in physical environments, and in digital, virtual environments. Now, this is still in experimental stages. So again, I don't know to what extent this method will reveal us something or will really offer us a better understanding about space. However, we define it, my colleagues, really exciting as a question. We can quite easily monitor the different types of brain waves while people explore, walk in the city, explore different environments, or are in front of the computer and navigate in specific virtual environments. So the question is, if we design very specific experiments through which we could map the brain response to very specific incentives, like change of light, change of sound, change of color, in a controlled lab environment and in the city, if these first few experiments could let us know if this tool and method could be explored further.
So very, very kind of exploratory research about, I suppose, even just testing the technology as much as testing theory and hoping for kind of practical results.
The other interesting aspect about this new project is that it couldn't be even start without a very close collaboration collaboration between neurologists, neurophysiologists, and architects.
Yeah.
Because it's not just two different disciplines inputting their knowledge, it's just that even that the experiments could not be designed without a very, very close interaction and collaboration. So that's another really interesting aspect that through this project our intention is also to explore cross-disciplinary the potential of cross-disciplinary collaborations and research.
And will you be doing this for a year, 3 years?
This has not been defined yet. We're starting some experiments and we'll see how it goes. If we figure out that there's also potential, we'll carry on examining that. If we see that actually it is not really revealing something interesting enough, maybe we will leave it for now. So I don't know how long we will be working on that.
We shall see. That's really interesting. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Caradinho. We've been talking about No Matter, theories and practices of the ephemeral in architecture.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London, and we've been talking to Dr. Anastasia Caradinho about her new book, No Matter, Theories and Practices of the Ephemeral in Architecture. Thanks for listening.